Okay. This is a picture of W.B. Yeats. He's one of my homies. And I think it was a portrait painted when he was a young guy by his brother. And it was about the time he fell in love irretrievably, madly, hopelessly for the rest of his life with an English woman named Maud Gunn. So he wrote a poem that was, you know, other people may be struck by what a stone fox you are, but I like who you really are as a person. I mean, he said it much more eloquently than that. But it's really called When You Were Old. And it has the line, something about other people may love you for the changing sorrows of your face, but I am the only one who loves your pilgrim soul. And I think that's very much a young person's poem. And my reaction to it, reading it at this age, though it's still a lovely piece of work, is wouldn't it be pretty to think so? Now, that's a line from The Sun Also Rises by Hemingway, and it's uttered by Lady Brett Ashley, who someone once said is one of my doppelgangers, which I never saw. I've never had a mad affair with a toreador, and my great love is not wounded in the war, but these things are subjective. Anyway, here are my two pilgrimages. The first one is called St. B&B. In the middle of this world, in a dark wood, I got myself to an Episcopalian Benedictine monastery in Santa Barbara. It was Mount Calvary I got myself to, a place I picked solely on the basis of the hokiness of its website, the niceness of the woman I talked with on its phone, and my strange continuing affinity with Episcopalians. Now, let me tell you a bit about the order. Saint Benedict was a guy who sought a monastic way of life, founded the monastery at Monte Cassino, which you may have heard of if you know about World War II, sometime around 500 AD, and wrote a set of rules on how to be and live in a monastery. The rule of Saint Benedict, while based on other contemporary musings on the subject, distilled a kind of genius and wisdom on the monastic life, and was adopted all over the world from then on. The Order of the Holy Cross, the flavor of Benedictines who run Mount Calvary, was founded in 1884 by a Harvard-educated Episcopalian who first worked among the poor immigrants on the Lower East Side of New York. Maybe he ran into my grandfather there. The order he founded was, from its beginning, devoted to good works and being good liberal kids, in addition to observing all the monastic ideals. As for Mount Calvary itself, the place is one of those life in the far west histories. A guy, Carl Tiedemann, who was sent out during World War II in part with a mission to the Pyramid Lake Paiute Indian Reservation in Nevada, and who became a famous itinerant preacher in the west, set out to found a western monastery for his order. Presto changeo, strange to behold, the Lord moves in mysterious ways, his wonders to behold. Tiedemann's path crossed that of Raymond Schofield. Schofield, who has a park named after him today in Santa Barbara, was a mogul who began work in the 1920s on a Larry Ellison-worthy McMansion atop one of the highest hills in Santa Barbara, which he in part envisioned as a place to entertain his pals in his exclusive riding fraternity, the Rancheros. The idea was that they would be able to gallop up the hill and thunder into the central court of his hacienda. However, the Depression had its way with this mini-mogul, and while Schofield somewhat recovered financially, he ended up selling the place, structurally complete but an unfinished shell, in 1947 for $47,500 for what would become a 40-bedroom retreat. Do not say anything. As for Tiedemann, who must have been a hell of a guy, he set out sweet-talking the grand dames of Montecito out of furniture and art to furnish the place. A priest friend of mine told me the story of another priest first arriving at Mount Calvary who said, "If this is poverty, I want to see chastity." Anglicanism, think Establishment Church of England, is the root form of Episcopalianism, and these are the folks with old money and taste in this country. Where would you rather be? In the Cathedral of St. John the Divine in New York, or some mid-60s multi-purpose room associated with some other denomination? Case in point, retreatants at Mount Calvary or Friendly Lot tending to commune in the best common rooms in the place, those with windows. But some of us are of the hermetic, solitary, okay, I'll say it, antisocial and misanthropic persuasion, and just like the anchorite desert fathers of the early church. We want the views, but we want to be alone. That's what we're there for. We don't want to be listening to other people yapping. So when I suggested to one of the kindly brothers that there be a designated quiet room, but with a view, he said, "That's a great idea. We could do fundraising for that. This is not a community that relies on bingo to help with its roof repairs." Being an Ashkenazi at Mount Calvary, like every Eastern European Jew I know, there are some semi-mythical rabbinical ancestors, and I retain an and unease with pork loin and with Catholic masses. I was reminded of the famous crack made about Sidwell Friends, the elite private school in Washington, D.C. Chelsea Clinton is its most famous recent alum. Sidwell Friends, where Quakers teach Jews how to act like Episcopalians. For I attended a snotty girls' school where we said the Lord's Prayer every day and had a school hymn, and there were, of course, quotas on Jews. So while the religion never rubbed off, like most Americans, I have a Clifton's cafeteria view of the spiritual life. Take what I like and ignore the rest, and I never disown my Jewish heritage except when it gets in my way. I am a calico cat, mixed breed creature, and have too many authority problems to relate to any religion. And to repeat Gore Vidal, Christianity is a theology for slaves. Forget the present, concentrate on the afterlife. Still, I've always had some pull towards something in that tradition, the stave churches, the art of the Northern Renaissance, the language of the Book of Common Prayer, the mystical tradition within Anglo-Catholicism, you know, like music and architecture and John Donne and George Herbert. But the quaint, if overly stated, belief system of Christianity was really not the point at Mount Calvary. For what the place really offers is the brand Hemingway turned into a market leader, the dream of the clean, well-lighted room. Only here, it has the value-add, platinum club member, bonus package, extra snacky goodness of spiritual harmony. I kept thinking about a scene in one of the novels of one of my favorite dead novelists, revived by the Virago imprint, the Brit Storm Jameson. In this novel, the author's stand-in protagonist remarked on how she felt when during the museum touristic walk through a smashingly lovely béguinage, that's French for convent, in Gand. A worldly woman of sex and business, she still felt the pull, I could live here forever, and was startled by her response. And I realized when reading that passage that I'd passed through the same place and felt the same thing. A friend of mine, who used to be the media minister at Grace Cathedral, once remarked to me, oh, my atheist friends have the best spiritual experiences. For what Jameson's creature and I both want is the startling bliss of solitude with safety and beauty. Take that, post-ranch inn. Monasteries at their best were enclaves of civilization and learning and community and tending to one's garden amidst a barbarian and brutish civilization. Yeah. Only now, post-1960 sociology, we talk about the flight from isolation and ennui of contemporary life, a life paradoxically characterized by sensory assault. And in addition, and as an improvement on Ventana or Sea Ranch or Elizabeth Arden's Main Chance, Mount Calvary provides the superior aesthetic of having actual monks on site. This makes their being there a real spiritual experience, not like a visit to a YMCA camp, which is nominally Christian but doesn't have that elevated look and feel. Yet the monks need tourist trade to support their living the monastic life. It's their equivalent of ecotourism producing traditional lifeways of people in the third world or in Hopi land. It's a divine symbiosis. I was also struck by how most of the retreatants were folks clearly in midlife crisis with a particular overrepresentation of middle-aged women, like me. There's always that superfluity of women 40, age 45 and older seeking healing or spirituality, whether it's You Go Girls, Writers Group, or Women Who Run With Wolves at AOL.com. Spirituality is said to be the last refuge of the coquette. Former supermodels are always finding religion and gurus. There's Shirley MacLaine and a woman who may have been Luciana Pignatelli, latterly Avedon, a Camé model from the 60s, who has publicly discussed at great length about her life among the rich and famous during the years of her great beauty, but now has become someone who chased after gurus. Now, the reason I'm not sure it's Pignatelli is that I read an interview with a woman in question a few years back and found it fascinating, but it was one of those at the doctor's office or at a friend's house or elsewhere reading experiences. So unlike everyone else on the planet, I don't steal other people's media, so I didn't take the feature with me. And obviously, I didn't think I would ever need to refer to it again, as much as the subject question provided a morbid fascination. But of course, I can't remember if it was in Harper's Bazaar, Vanity Fair, or some other slick that I read about her, and I don't remember her name. And cyber-utopian fantasies to the contrary, not everything is online. And that which is online isn't easily searchable. So while Pignatelli might be my exemplar, she might not be. So if she's not, I beg her pardon. And isn't it so much more that an aging once beauty finds comfort in her past lives, whether in another decade. Think of Madame Hortense, the utterly former courtesan in Zorba the Greek, with her tales of her generals, or in another incarnation. Religion is so often the comfort of women. Recall when Helen Mirren has foisted it off on the priests when, sick in late-stage pregnancy in the Merchant Ivory production of Forster's Where Angels Fail to Tread, her ridiculously too young, too handsome Italian new husband has grown tired of her. Old women are usually the last remaining parishioners all over Christendom. So I felt sorry for this Benedictine company of men in the Anglican Communion, sworn to a life not mated, who spent the majority of their time with women. It's rather like the phenomenon of gay hairdressers and fashion designers. That which you abjure and want no part of, you end up being surrounded by. And I was more than a little nonplussed by how that ready to be of service ma'am the monks were, solicitous and full of that good cheer that members of caring Christian communities in fantasy extend everywhere to all God's children. Ick. I don't believe in caring and sharing, at least not on a general principle, and I don't think everyone is lovable. In fact, I don't believe in unconditional love at all. And as Huntington Hartford said, the public be damned. Not to mention, I've only experienced that personalized attentiveness in places where folks are paid gobs of money and or in terror of losing their jobs and or bucking for promotion or trying to promote repeat business. That is where the humans in question are both enslaved by and goaded on by the powerful minor dark side demiurges of fear and greed or suffer from having no powers of discrimination whatsoever. But it turns out these guys belong to that order of the Benedictines that sees as its mission hospitality to the stranger. Being around these monks gave me a glimpse of what it must have been like to have taken a transatlantic passage on the SS Normandy. Were you warm enough last night? How are your hands? Things I magically needed appeared in my room. Books I might be interested in were given to me over lunch. Email addresses and author names for further study were handwritten out for me in beautiful neo-Gothic, poster-worthy italic printing. So I came to think of them as having as their patron saint, Saint B&B, which is either Saint Breakfast in Bed, Saint Bed and Breakfast, or Saint Brandy and Benedictine. They weren't of that nasty old mortifying the flesh school of monasteries past, where by keeping the anchorites cold, hungry, and dirty, the body is shuffled off and shunted away in pursuit of higher things. They describe their hostel as a ministry of Benedictine hospitality. We wish to make your stay with us as pleasant and refreshing as possible. Please feel free to let guest house staff know what your needs are when you're here. I wonder if the Cornell Hotel Stool allows its sophomores to have summer internships at Mount Calvary. Theirs is a much more comfy, modern, Tony, Esalen-inspired, living well is the best revenge philosophy. Luke's calm and volupté are the way to find God. If you understand this to mean good food and great views and fabu architecture, good bones will tell. And a sanctuary with the austere ecumenical beauty of a zendo and perfect feng shui for the site. All rooms seem best oriented to take advantage of the stunning location. Maximum doors and windows everywhere to provide fun and easy egress and multiple routes to everything. Openness is the watchword. And high ceilings and bedside lamps at just the right distance from the bed. Let's just say most expense account hotels I've stayed in weren't as well oriented for rest and good things to look out on. Only you cannot even ordinarily pay gazillions of dollars to be in a space like this. A magnificent old building with beam ceilings, mullion windows, long hallway suggesting Velasquez paintings, multiple libraries. I had puzzled over the collection of books, varied and idiosyncratic, and titles from the 1920s through the present day. The assortment reminded me of the quirky wonderfulness of artwork assembled by a collector rather than a curator. Turns out the holdings represent the tastes and individual curiosities as spread out over time of the individual monks who've been there, multiple smart private collectors, in a sense. The building was of the peculiarly blessed and uniquely Californian early 20th century vernacular. Call it soundstage colonial. It pays homage to the California missions with their solidity and cathedral beauty, without all the nasty overtones of epidemics, enslavement, and forced conversion. The Athenaeum at Caltech, another kind of unique to California monastery, is another such sacred hall. Think Magister Ludi. The views out to sea and up the mountain are of the, on a clear day, you can see forever, only the super rich and very privileged usually get to have. Whoever situated the visions of Provence Garden oriented it so that what you see is the Channel Islands, evoking thoughts of the Islands of the Blessed, and never the oil derricks offshore. Somehow evocations of Ray Manzarek and the crystal ship aren't once wanted here, nor memories of those poor dying birdies from the oil spill of 1970. Long time now, status mode means being unplugged. You have assistants who handle your voicemail and email. But there is a forgotten luxury in the electromagnetic quiet of being in a place where there are no telephones or televisions or broadband internet connections, and you have the utter psychic security of leaving your room unlocked. It's the kind of stillness where the eventual buzzing of the bees and the rosemary seems over the top. It's not that all you need is the air that you breathe, but between the snug, solitary spare room with the view, the high, whitewashed walls, and the great silence that begins every night, ending not after bells for vigils, 6:15 a.m., nor by the bells for lauds, 7:30 a.m., but only after breakfast, 8:15 a.m., there's a blessed self-sufficiency. Peace that passeth understanding isn't exactly the peace of God. I don't believe in God. But yes, it does consist of being able to listen to that still, private voice within. It's not precisely that heaven is a place where nothing ever happens, or that paradise is definitionally always a walled garden. It is perhaps that the child's vision of paradise remains our own, that place where we are loved and left alone. We are supported and allowed to be. Praise be. And now we have Asclepion. Get rid of Yeats. Okay. I've been having sort of a hard time for the last year. So in my franticness, and because I have nothing else to do, and I think I've ended my lifetime with therapy, and I tend to be polymorphous perverse and a bit of a pagan and open to anything, so I've been seeking out lots of spiritual healing. Now, some of these experiences have been pretty funny. I did a phone consult with a woman who lived in the Southern California desert, famously a homeland for seers and kooks and prophets, and she said that what my problem was is that I was spending too much of my time on Arcturus, which is why I was having such a hard time here on Earth. I kind of don't think that's true. Now, if you know anything about the woo-woo side of life, Arcturus and Saint Germain, who turns out to be another one of my homies, was a favorite of Edgar Cayce. So clearly she was operating in this New Age tradition that had passed out of fashion decades ago. The people I know in Hollywood had already passed Edgar Cayce by the end of the 1970s. And then I had a consult with a very sweet woman. She was blind, but she said she could see my aura in colors. And I thought, well, I hope that means she became blind as an adult and not at birth. She had just gotten over several brain tumors, so the experience was kind of strange. And she said, oh, no, you're not stuck, which is not mapped into my life 9 months since I talked to her. She was full of helpful recommendations, like I should touch my fingers to each other in certain ways, squeezing them together, and that this will get the energy flowing properly and all will be well. Well, I just don't think anything is that simple. So I've had many other spiritual adventures over the last 9 months. A really lovely woman who teaches acupuncture at a traditional Chinese medicine college in Hawaii is a shamanic healer. She's very matter-of-fact, and I enjoyed her, and I would feel better after talking to her. But what do you make of the fact that someone sees in your aura glittering, insect-like parasites or nasty dark forces where the person says, I've never seen anything like this, and I don't know what to do with it, and I've got to bring in my astral Tibetan sorcerer's knife to kill the stuff? Well, that's really helpful. Or she sees me as having a past life as a nun from somewhere in Asia who was captured by some bad people and was tortured to death by having her feet nailed to the floor of a ship, and then the ship sank. And I thought, well, that's kind of how I feel for sure, but I don't know how helpful this is. But I really liked her. She was good. The spiritual journey kind of ended with my seeing a really quite wonderful astrologer who lived in the back of beyond of the Santa Cruz Mountains. He used to be an engineer for Bechdel, a nice Jewish boy from New York, and somewhat disabled. You gotta love a guy with a limp. Lived in a funky little trailer overhung by drippy redwoods. I tend to like wounded healers. Poor wounded Chiron was the best of the centaurs, and Apollo did help him found modern medicine, and he was the first astrologer. I do think they have something. And he was the best of the lot, partly because what he had to say was a very cold comfort. Yeah, you're really stuck, and you're going through a major life transformation, and I know you want it to be over, but too bad, it's not. I think the most amusing encounter I had with the numinous, though, came about when a friend of mine was trying to help me out, because he knew how incredibly unhappy I was and how agitated and sleepless and full of suicidal ideation and kind of bedeviled. and lots of anvils were falling on me from above, both literally and figuratively, and it had been 4 years of things blowing up and things not working out, and me kind of just having had it. Now, this friend is the most psychically and spiritually gifted person I know, but he's also, like anyone else, got his blind spots. So he was frantically trying to think of, what can I do to help you? What can I do to help you? So I don't know how he found these people, but he suggested I go to this place called Asclepion in Marin County. You could make a reservation over the phone and show up and get some sort of a healing. And I thought, well, okay, I've been to Esalen twice. I've been to Tassajara. I've had good massages in my life. I've had great polarity therapy. I'll try anything. I'm open. So I went to Asclepion. It's a two-story, either former office building or maybe apartment building in San Rafael. I think anything woo-woo in Marin is automatically to be yellow-tagged. So I showed up at this place, and of course it was all women. I think it's geared towards women, but of course it was all women because women always seek out this kind of healing. There must have been, I would say, 20 women in the waiting room. So I gave them my name and looked around and wondered what was going on. So I was just sitting there waiting, and then I realized that all of a sudden one of the women was beginning to have her session in front of all 18 of us. One woman was standing behind her and putting her hands on her head, and then two women were sitting in front of her going into trance, and I was watching this and thinking, wait a minute, are they having a session here in front of all 18 other people? What's going on here? And I was thinking, no, no, no. I don't know what this could really be about, but I waited to see what else would happen. Then my name was called 5 minutes later, and I was taken into another room, and I realized the same thing was going to happen to me. There were three other people having their sessions going on. So there I was listening to, for example, this woman who was very fit and very thin and very high maintenance and very tight and very taut and very buffed. You know, the kind of woman who has a toned body and probably had her first facelift. I could hear from her conversation that she was, I guess, trying to get IV fertilization. So she was processing with her spiritual people about how, you know, I don't want to get too attached or over-identify with being pregnant and not grieve too much if it doesn't work. And I'm thinking, wait, 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 I don't know you. I don't want to know all this about you. So there are all these other people having their sessions around me. The two people they assigned to me sat in front of me, went into trance, and after 40 minutes of this, I came away with this one question from the leader of the trance session. What's your main creative outlet? To which I responded, being a writer. To which he responded, eyes closed and lids fluttering, you're feeling kind of blocked these days, aren't you? Yes. And that was kind of it. $40. So I walked out of there going, I don't fucking believe this. But money was not the part that bothered me, because you pay different amounts for these things and it's never that much, so fine. But then it struck me that this place Asclepion is kind of like Est, or multi-level marketing, because they have a class you can attend weekly for 4 weeks, which teaches you how to be a psychic, which I don't think you can teach. I think it's something either people have the gift for or they don't. So the people doing the healing readings were probably the people who had probably all been to the 4 week class and were now like practicing on the new clients coming in. Nothing beats the viral wealth building power of multi-level marketing. So as I was walking out of there, I was thinking, I don't believe this. But then as I got into my car, it came to me what the experience reminded me of. Back in the 70s, in the era of our bodies ourselves, with women taking back their bodies from the patriarchal medical establishment and sisters doing it for each other, and I was in a gestalt feminist women's group in Berkeley, I'm not even going to be ashamed of it, it was the times, I was having a hard time with contraception. I have a very sensitive body, and I can't take birth control pills, and I can't use a diaphragm. I'd had a Dalkin shield, which, as we all know, had a minor product liability unpleasantness, so I had to have it taken out. So I was kind of freaking out about contraception. At the time, cervical caps were not legal in this country, didn't have that FDA approval, so what was I going to do? Enter the Oakland Women's Health Collective, which ran a kind of gray market in contraception. So you go to this office in a kind of funky, rundown part of Oakland, and the organizers would have groups of maybe 10 women at a time, where everyone had to take the clothes off the lower half of their body. So there you are with a bunch of other women, naked from the waist down, and I am private. I was struck looking at these women basically naked from their tummies to their toes, that actually we don't all look that different when our clothes are off. So this very public assembly line began in what was effectively the waiting room of a dingy office. The women who ran this thing worked their way through us all, attempting to fit you with the right kind of cervical cap, And once you were fitted, you had to demonstrate your competence by removing and reinserting the cap correctly in front of your sisters and taking back our power, owning your own sexuality, and being comfortable with your body. All of which was fine by me. I just didn't want to have to do it in front of an audience. So I'm just freaking out and totally freezing. Get me out of here! I don't like this! I feel violated! I didn't say that. I felt it. Then, of course, I was even more bad because it turns out, because I'm even more peculiar physically than I'd previously realized, that they couldn't fit me. My body not getting with a progressive program somehow made me not be ideologically pure enough. The woman writing up my case notes with deep disapproval on her face spelled woman, women, W-I-M-M-I-N, and I never did figure out if this was illiteracy or righteousness, for it was obvious if I'd been right-minded enough and on the side of collective action, I would have been able to have been fitted for a cervical cap. And I just walked out of there going, oh my God. And I realized that at Asclepion, I'd had the exact same experience as at the Oakland Women's Health Collective. Both women-empowered enterprises are predicated on the idea that we're all interchangeable, we're all willing to do anything in front of anyone else, provided it's another woman, and that because we're all women, we're all sisters under the skin and don't mind getting any kind of undressed in front of each other. It's this weird, overmerged, symbiotic, all women are equivalent thing that just scares me to death. It's the same experience that I'll have when I'm in a bathroom in some public place and someone I've encountered for the first time 10 seconds before, because we're both standing at the sink, will comment to me about her PMS or her cramps. And I want to shriek, do I know you? And do I want to know this? But again, it's the solidarity of we're all in this together. I'm sure it works great for many people, but it's just one of those many instances where I feel like I'm a traitor to my gender. Thank you.